Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Silent breed is people!
No, I am the father.
Rosebud. What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I am Sam Adams, a culture editor here at Slate, and today we are spoiling the movie Blinded by the Light. Blinded by the Light is the story of Javed, the British-born son of Pakistani immigrants who becomes obsessed with the music of Bruce Springsteen. It's the 1980s, the height of Thatcherism, the resurgence of the racist National Front, and the golden age of synth pop, all of which makes Springsteen deeply unfashionable. But Javed, an aspiring writer who bristles at the future laid out for him by his immigrant father, finds that Springsteen's stories of dead-end life and young male rebellion speak to him, and that sets him at odds with both his family and his peers. Based on a true story, the movie is co-written and directed by Bend It Like Beckham's Gurinder Chadha, and it's in theaters now. Joining me to spoil Blinded by the Light are Ingu Kang, a staff writer at Slate, and Nitish Pawa, a copy editor at Slate. Ingu, hello.
Hello, hello.
And Nitish, hello.
Hello.
All right, so let us start in traditional fashion by saying what we thought and would we recommend this movie. Nitish, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So I, too, was kind of going into this expecting more of the classic Gurinder Chadha fare, something more along the lines of Bend It Like Beckham or like a Pride and Prejudice. I was definitely surprised a little bit by how it turned out. I thought it was very moving in a lot of parts. It was a very smart look at the immigrant experience at a specific moment in time, a specific point. But I did think at other times the musical elements also turned a little corny.
When you say you were expecting the traditional Gurinder Chadha affair, could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's that East-West dynamic, which I think she's pretty much always done. The I'm a person living in a more Western culture. I am born into the society. I'm not an immigrant like my parents. I'm trying to find something new. And it definitely was something along those lines, but it was actually a lot darker, I thought, than some of her earlier stuff because, you know, the scenes with the National Front, the prevalence of the skinheads, the racist movement there, it was definitely less of feel good in some parts, but I thought that made it more effective.
Yeah, Ingu, what did you think?
I also went into the movie dreading it a little bit because I was also expecting it to be something pretty much like we had seen before. And I think it does something really different in this like third act that I'm sure we will discuss at length. One thing I did find interesting was that I listened to a podcast interview with Kim Masters on a podcast called The Business, which is about the entertainment industry. And essentially, Gurinder Chadha talked about how she wasn't really sure that she was going to make this movie because she thought it was too similar to stuff she had done previously. And the reason why she felt motivated to do it was that Brexit happened. And after Brexit happened, she really felt compelled to sort of take a stand with a movie. And this seemed like a really good movie with which to do that. And I think that that element of the movie was interesting because it was, as Tish said, darker than everyone, than I think a lot of people were expecting.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about some of that when we get to the ending, but it is definitely like not a movie that I went where expected. I think we share, all of us, the experience of going into this movie kind of dreading it a little bit, like expecting, I was expecting kind of something like sort of, you know, straightforward and inspirational and young man, you know, finds himself listening to Bruce Springsteen songs, which is just like, I kind of roll my eyes, like even just saying that like made up sentence now, like, oh, he's going to listen to Born to Run and then he's going to run. And it kind of is that movie for, you know, an hour and change or something like that. And then it goes like some more like interesting places towards the end. And that was when I really started to, I became a lot more interested in it. I'm, you know, still not sure like that. It's a pretty sort of hard left it takes at the end, and I'm not sure it totally lands, but I think it, I mean, it definitely makes it like a much more interesting movie. And I think it does sort of, you know, lean into finally into some of the complexities, particularly of Springsteen's kind of later work and the stuff he's said about it, and the stuff he said about his earlier work more recently, which is a sort of good time to ask in a similar spirit, kind of where you came into this, like with regard to Springsteen's music, like as a fan, as a doubter, as someone who's just like, it's going to like explode if I hear Thunder Road one more time. where do you stand on Bruce?
I am not a pop culture connoisseur. And so I was at the level of, oh, I didn't know this was a Springsteen song. and I'm sure it was like one of his like five most famous songs. I will say that so much of the movie captures like this like really aggressive 80s ugliness that I think a lot of people associate with things like hair rock. And so it was very interesting. I mean, it's sort of the point for all of this guitar angsty, like brooding white guy music to go along with the visuals that we saw on screen that we generally associate more with pop, because it's implied that's sort of where British culture in this pocket of England has already moved on to. But I wish I could say like the music was more interesting to me. I think it's sort of just like it is what it is. But I also always believed Javed's enthusiasm for the music.
Yeah. Tish, what about you? Where do you stand on Bruce?
I'm a pretty thorough Springsteen fan, and I was not expecting like, you know, any deep cuts or any nerddom like that. And I was expecting to hear, you know, most of the songs that you usually hear, Born to Run, Hungry Heart, all that, which you did. But something I wondered, did you guys get the sense that this movie was kind of raucous? Because, you know, there's that part where they're talking about, you know, this is a country of synths. You know, no one cares about Bruce anymore, even though Bruce still had, like, a very productive career around that time in the 80s, I'm pretty sure. I think Tunnel in Love was around that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little, they may, I guess to use a Britishism, over-egg the pudding a little bit. But, I mean, I think that, you know, if you're talking about, like, small town, kind of, you know, not particularly hip high school, but desperately wanting to be hip high school students in Britain in the 80s. Like, I think it's their, I mean, there's one point where they have like the college radio station playing Tiffany, which or like Debbie Gibson. And I'm just like, okay, like, I mean, would even if the, I feel like no college radio station would ever play anything like that, pop, like even in England. But I mean, I think the dominance of synth music, like at that, I mean, there was definitely was a sense that like guitars were dead, that they sort of belonged to, you know, punk, and they had sort of moved past that, and it was much more dominated by synth music at the time. And I mean, and an interesting thing about the movie is that actually the movie is kind of like that too. I mean, I think it's probably, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour before we hear a guitar. And I mean, you get a lot of cutting crew and, you know, men without hats and stuff like that. And the first song that's mentioned in it, but I don't think we hear, but there's an opening voiceover where Javed says his favorite song is Baggy Trousers by Madness, which is like a, you know, sort of, you know, British, you know, ska song. So there's a lot more kind of, you know, new wave and kind of new romantic stuff at the beginning, which I think does maybe sort of give a little bit of context for people who didn't live through that era in the first place. And I agree with you, like, it does really capture just the kind of, like, you know, dinginess of the 80s. I mean, I like the fact that, you know, the kids are, I mean, they're, you know, they're wearing sort of like, you know, sort of like funky hats and like, the, you know, blazers, and they have their hair up in this kind of semi, like, you know, Flock of Seagulls thing. But it's really, it's like, it's, they're not doing it like very well. You know, they don't look like they, like somebody just watch a bunch of music videos and then like style them like that. These are sort of like, you know, crappy small town kids attempt at like mimicking like whatever they're seeing in The Enemy that week or whatever. So that felt very like true to life to me, that part of it. It is sort of, as someone who lived through them and that does not have a tremendous amount of fondness for the 1980s, as a result of that, it did resemble the 1980s that I remember and I'm glad we are no longer living in.
There is a scene where a lot of that synth adoration is personified by Matt, who is a sort of like childhood best friend that he is slowly becoming less and less good friends with. And there is a moment where Javed gives him crap for loving synth so much. And then toward the end of the movie, Javed sort of says something along the lines of like, oh, Bruce is really meaningful to me, but obviously this music is really meaningful to you too. So I'm sorry for being such an asshole about like how much better Bruce is than, I don't know, Flock of Seagulls or whatever. And which I thought was like a very good thing. It's sort of like a gesture instead of like a full turn on Javed's part, but I'm glad that the movie wasn't completely unaware of its own rockism.
Right. I mean, it's sort of the scene that's set up there is Javed and his family. They are, they say the only Pakistani family, and I think from what we see, the only kind of non-white family in the, on their street in Luton, which is kind of an industrial town in England. I have, it's also the subject of a David Keel show called We're Only Alive for a Short Amount of Time, which I saw a few months ago at the Public Theater, and there's a whole song in there about like what a shithole Luton is. So I'm very like influenced by that in watching this movie. But yeah, his father is, you know, very sort of classically hardworking. He and his wife immigrated from Karachi and have set up life here. His father has been working in the Vauxhall motor plant in Luton for 16 years, has kind of, you know, built a life for them, but is a very kind of strict demand, sort of absolute obedience from his children. And for Javed's father, you know, his insistence that the proof that he's actually kind of liberal-minded is he's not insisting that he grow up to be a doctor. He could also grow up to be a lawyer or a real estate agent or an engineer. So, you know, he has this choice of like five careers instead of one. But Javed, and this is, Javed wants to be a writer. He writes poems mostly. He keeps a diary. He's been attempting to write lyrics for his friend Matt's synth-pop band. But because Matt has a girlfriend and Javed has apparently never had one, his attempts to write, you know, love songs for them come off pretty flat and uninformed. He mostly wants to write sort of, you know, political songs about how fascists are bad, which is not the kind of thing that Matt wants to be singing while, like, you know, standing in front of a Roland or a Moog. So Javed is surrounded by synth pop, and it's not really doing it for him, although he doesn't really know what else he wants. But he makes a discovery when he goes off to sixth form, which is kind of like the British equivalent of sort of the last few years of high school. On his first day at school, Javed runs into Roops, who's a sixth student, also kind of a new face. And he is listening to something very intently in his Walkman, because this is, again, the 1980s, and does not know what it is. So Javed asks him, and Roops just says kind of cryptically, "The boss." Javed doesn't know what that means, and Roops only tells him, "Oh, the boss of us all." But later on, they kind of, you know, re-encounter each other in the lunchroom, and Javed asks for an explanation, and that's when Roops kind of hands him two cassettes, one of Born in the USA and Darkness on the Edge of Town, and says to him to guard them with his life. So Javed takes them home and has kind of his big epiphany, the one that we've been, we know from the title of the movie, is coming eventually, and just starts listening to the music and really finds that he's kind of swept away. It's Dancing in the Dark and then Promised Land, which is a song that comes back several times in the movie and has, we kind of find more and more meaning in it. But he, you know, he starts kind of listening at his desk in his room, and the words from the songs are kind of appearing on screen behind him. And then he's like, you know, there's a big like windstorm running outside and there's like a little tornado in his, you know, up by the curb. And so he's kind of opens his window and is like just, you know, staring out into the darkness and feeling the wind blow on him. And then his sister comes in and is like, what are you doing, you big weirdo? So then he runs outside. I think at some point we even like lose the Walkman. So he's just kind of like, you know, running outside, like, you know, playing air guitar, doing sort of, you know, these big like kind of musical gestures, and the lyrics are kind of growing larger and larger, and they're being like projected on the side of buildings. And it, you know, it's all this stuff about, you know, wanting to prove that you're a man and kind of defining yourself and feeling trapped in your small town life. And that really, you know, and that has a lot to, so much to do with Springsteen's relationship to where he grew up and his dad, and got a very much by extension, like Javed's relationship to Luton and his father. And that's like so much of the movie turns on that. You know, he feels that this need to get out, partly because he's kind of living in this, you know, cul-de-sac that is, you know, frequented by like skinheads who want to like spit in his face and beat the shit out of him. But also because, you know, his dad kind of won't give him the freedom to, he has to kind of like sneak off and take a writing class in school, because if his dad found out, he'd be upset with him. So, you know, he just feels kind of constrained in every way. And Springsteen is kind of his window into another world.
I think, I mean, I'm glad you brought up the dad, because I think the father-son relationship in this movie is really like the core of the movie. And I think in a lot of ways, the dad is really this very, like, I think on the one hand, this like almost caricaturish figure, mm-hmm. where he is so overbearing. And also the dad is like very much himself. And but I think like on the other hand, as the movie goes along, you get like a better sense of why the dad is so fervid in his own beliefs and so fervid in his idea that like Javed has to succeed in like a very particular way. Because if he doesn't succeed in these very particular ways, then there is a grave chance that none of the white people around him will give him a chance. And I think that we sort of see this as the movie goes along. And the father, who has, as Sam mentioned, worked for 16 years at this factory, is like very summarily laid off. And it doesn't really matter what sort of sacrifices he's made for the company. It's just that he's like one more disposable source of labor, right? And so you do get the sense that the father is sort of preparing his son to succeed, in because he doesn't think that like his son will be able to succeed in ways that like other people in British society will be able to succeed.
Yeah, and there's kind of a recurring conversation between them which feels timeless but also particularly inflected by Brexit, about whether or not Javed is British, you know, and his father says, you're not British, you'll never be British, like, don't, you know, they'll never accept you. And so you can sort of keep your head down and do your work and be successful like that way, but you're not really part of this country. And that is probably not a line that would have been prominently featured in the film if it had made, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago. What did you think of the dad, Tish?
The dad was a figure that I feel is very sort of common in a lot of these, you know, East West dialogues. Like, he's the man who considers himself the man of the house. And once he's like laid off from his job, he feels almost very like emasculated because of it. He like lashes out at the mom to like work harder to support the family, lashes out at Javed to, you know, get an actual job so that you can actually like help out with us. I'm going to take your money, you know, so on, so that the family can be supported. And there are some touches in there. Obviously, this is a Pakistani family, not quite the same as my experience, but there were touches in here that I found like very relatable, like at least with other Indian Pakistani dads I've known, where there's like that need for the money to go toward the daughter's wedding. Like, that's such an important part of these cultures, that every single cent needs to be poured into this, and the family needs to selflessly work toward that, because it needs to be a big occasion, it needs to be a very important thing. Or that scene where the dad is also talking to his wife, saying, you know, I feel like I have failed you all, even though it's obviously not necessarily his fault. It's just a very Thatcherite Britain, just completely austere, privatized. Right. So those last two parts I mentioned kind of like deepen him in ways that made him more than just the typical son, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that, even though that is what he is for a large part of the film.
Right. I mean, one thing I kept thinking about and kind of, you know, I don't know, you know, being uneasy with or, you know, a little frustrated by during the film was the way this relationship with the father, you know, is being depicted, which is, you know, rhymes, as you say, with a lot of these sort of like East-West, like sort of, you know, first, second generation immigrant dramas, and also with, you know, the Springsteen songs that are laid over because this is only the movie set in, you know, like, you know, 84, 85. So obviously we're only dealing with, you know, the first 10 years of Springsteen albums or so. And so it is all these songs about like kind of rebellion and getting out and, you know, getting away from, you know, particularly your dad and the, you know, and sort of getting away from that life. And it really, I kept thinking about the way Springsteen has talked about his dad since, you know, particularly he talked the way he talked about him in his the Springsteen on Broadway show, which I saw on his, and there's a film of on Netflix now. And he talks a lot in that about not exactly kind of regretting the stance he took in those early songs, but just how, you know, as Springsteen has gotten older and become a father, and after his, you know, his dad died, he felt like, you know, so much of that stuff came out of this profound like admiration for his father that he could never, you know, quite make him see. And one of the things he says he kind of wished he would have said to his dad is, you know, Springsteen is kind of this classic embodiment of the kind of working class hero. But as he points out in the show, he never worked like a regular job a day in his life. You know, he never worked in a factory. He never kind of did any of that stuff. So that character in his songs is really, and the one he kind of, you know, played on stage to a certain extent is kind of his idealized version of his father, you know, and is really that profound investment and admiration of the kind of working class striver, you know, laying and who laid the groundwork for his son to become an artist is, you know, so much of that informs the music. And I was just kept wondering if the movie was going to come to terms with that part of it. I mean, it's Springsteen wise, it's anachronistic, but I mean, I think it's, you kind of have to see. And it also just, this is just a song about, like, you know, a young man getting away from his parents and getting out and going off to be an artist. Like, that seems, would have seemed kind of unsatisfying and, I don't know, extremely American among other things.
I think it kind of got to that stage, like, a little bit near the end, although I kind of wish it had developed more. The scene where Javed is, like, you know, reading his poem and he sees his dad and the family finally standing at the back, and then Javed, after seeing that, becomes so emotional, he kind of comes up with his own thing about, my dad is here, he sacrificed so much for my family, I admire him so much for that, you know, I respect him for that, despite all this, you know, rebellion and stuff that I've been doing for myself to express myself as well. So I think that in like an alternate form is him, like, you know, coming to terms with like his dad's sacrifice and, you know, him like realizing the dream that his dad wanted for him, but in just a different way, and his dad coming to terms with that as well.
So. I think the other really interesting thing about the dad, although this also isn't super developed in the movie, is that the dad really cares about the Pakistani community in that area, where he goes to a lot of different people's homes and he makes sure that they're okay. And he spends so much time doing this that the family sort of resents him. And I think that the dad sort of tries to play off his generosity. There's like a really funny line early in the movie where they go to another Pakistani family's house nearby. And the two dads are sort of joking about how, like, oh, like, this neighborhood used to be good, and then all of these, like, Pakistani families moved in, and now it's terrible. which I think is, like, a very good joke in terms of sort of diverting audience expectations. But also, it gives you, like, a sense of the fact that, like, the dad really wants to make sure that even though he's joking around about the influx of Pakistani families, like, in the area, he wants to make sure that they're taken care of. He wants to keep track of how the local mosque is doing, which happens to be under threat of, is it bombing by local skinheads? And so at some point, Javed sort of asks him, like, why are you spending all of this time away from the family? And you're not even getting any money for it. And the dad gets really offended and says something like, why, would you expect that I would take money for like doing what I'm supposed to be doing? And I thought that was also like another really good way of humanizing the dad.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is really, it's, and I think, like, you know, Bennett like Beckham certainly does this. I mean, it's, you know, it's very like kind of heavily, you know, tropey in places. I mean, and, you know, it is, this is a movie where, you know, the Javed's like, you know, first day at school, he sits down and there's his English teacher, you know, writing the words like, why are you here? On the blackboard, and then she starts, you know, talking about the curriculum for this, and they're going to, you know, sort of read stuff by, you know, universal voices like Shakespeare and Virginia Woolf, and it's like universal, wink, wink, you know, so it's definitely not shy about scenes like that, but then it does have a way, you know, this is a movie where there's a sequence where he and Rips are kind of running around like singing Born to Run in this kind of borderline, like, you know, musical theater sequence where they don't quite, they're like kind of singing, you can sort of hear them, but like the real song is playing underneath them, and they get to the line "Tramps Like Us," and he literally like points at a hobo on the street. You know, and you're just like, you're just like, okay, like that's the movie we're watching. Yeah. Like, is that Tramps Like Him? See? Yeah. But I think that kind of cheeseball corniness is like, that's also, if you're gonna love Bruce Springsteen's music, like you have to embrace some of that as well. Like, you know, it's a lot of it is like kind of ridiculous and over the top, and you know, a lot of it is kind of like musical theater for straight white guys, but I mean, it's like you just gotta lean into that excess and over the topness of it and embrace that as well if you're gonna kind of get anything out of the songs.
Yeah, that's why I found the song choice here so interesting as well, because it really is just like some of Springsteen's biggest, like, most bombastic songs. Like, you know, it's not Nebraska or Town of Love. So, you know, it's all, like, Born to Run. Like you say, you know, it's Hungry Heart, This Promised Land. It's literally everything that's just, like, the biggest vision of Springsteenism, as it were, that it can be.
Right.
You know? So it lends itself very well to that sort of thing. Obviously, she really wants to play that up, Jatha, in directing this. But that it also made me wonder sometimes how aware this film was, whether it wanted to be like a musical or not, because there were just like these sequences in between, but it didn't feel very like consistent to me, you know what I mean? Like the musical sequences, there's that scene where there's Javed and Roops are at the diner with like the skinheads, and they just start like screaming the lyrics to Badlands at them. I think it's Badlands.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
And yeah, and then they start walking out and it starts playing, and I'm just like, oh wait, oh, so that's how we're gonna seek into that.
There are a lot of sequences like that. The Born to Run one is a really like interesting one for me. That kind of starts when he is at kind of like an outdoor market. He's taken a kind of a part-time job selling clothes for Matt's dad, who's played by Rob Brydon. And he's sort of like the old like rock dude in the movie. Like he's when Javed said he's into Bruce Springsteen, everyone else is like, oh, really? Like, nobody cares about Springsteen anymore. Matt's dad is like, oh, all right, yeah. So he starts, you know, Javed, like, puts on his Walkman just to, like, occupy him while he's doing the songs. But then he starts singing, and then Rob Brydon joins in. And then they're both kind of singing and, like, pointing at people. And they're sort of, like, singing to people around. But then people start dancing, and then there's, like, a whole... then the kids are like kind of running through the streets, and there's like a whole like kind of street crew like kind of break dancing in time to the song, and it's you know, then it becomes like more of sort of a full musical sequence. But that was like the moment when Rob Brydon joins in and starts singing with him. Like, that for me was like one of the most moving moments in the movie, just because it's just about like so corny, but just like kind of the power of music. Like, the, you know, when Roop's like hands him the tapes and is like, guard these with your life. Like, it's so over the top, but I so clearly remember like being a teenager and being so invested in not just like music, but in the, you know, what at the time were these very like limited objects, you know, that it's like you possessed the tape of this music so you could listen to it, and if someone else wanted to listen to it, they had to like, you know, borrow the tape or copy it or something, and just the kind of like specialness of just having access to it, it's so easy to like take for granted, you know.
Sounds
like
hard. I'm so glad I'm very young.
Yes.
Going back to the musical aspect of it, I think that I overall liked the fact that it was not really, it was very much not a jukebox musical, right? Like, you don't really have the characters singing the songs on their own. You hear Bruce a lot more than you hear anybody else. And I like that there were sort of these like gestures toward a musical without actually going full musical. And I think that as a person who is not particularly invested in Springsteen's music, if the movie had slowed down in order to like make space for like a whole 3-minute rendition or something, I think on the one hand, it would have slowed down the movie considerably. And it's already like a pretty long-ish movie. And I think number two, if you sort of had like that polished, bobbly aspect of a musical, I don't think it would have really worked with sort of this gritty, shitty, small town where everyone kind of sucks.
Right.
those two things would not have melded together. And so I sort of like that it was sort of this willfully half-assed musical.
Right. That's, I mean, there's one point, I think it's the first time, like the first time Javed's listening to Dancing in the Dark, like he starts listening to the song and then he presses stop and fast forwards. Just, it's just like they can condense the song like a little bit, but it's like, who stops a song? Like they're supposedly having this transcendent experience to like the first time they're listening to it and like fast forwards is like, oh, maybe there's a better line 10 seconds for it. It's just, that's just so something that is like so bizarre. And I think it's just there to like condense the number a little bit so that it's not like wall-to-wall music for 45 minutes. And I think maybe...
And there's 19 Bruce Springsteen songs here, so
yeah, there's only
like wall-to-wall Bruce.
Yeah, I think is like Born to Run the only one you hear all the way through? Like there's only like one or two that you actually get all of, and then a lot of the others it's just like, you know, a couple lines or a couple minutes.
Yeah, I think Born to Run is definitely the fullest sequence. That even features like the instrumental transitions and also like the little where do they do the 1, 2, 3, 4, and
yes,
then did a little jump. So, yeah, I think you're right about that. It's mostly like snippets of the other one. Speaking of, what did you guys think of the use of the lyrics just like being read out in the air? Like you could see the lyrics as they were being like heard by Javed in real time, projected on the screen. I did not love it. I thought it was very corny.
That was my least favorite aspect of the movie. Like it's already such a worshipful movie, and the sort of like scriptural treatment that the movie gave Bruce Springsteen's lyrics by putting his words up on the screen and just having like the lead actor like close his eyes and just feel them. It was just like one smidge too far.
Right. I mean, and I just generally believe that that is like a cruel thing to do to rock lyrics, especially like they're not really meant to be, you know. It's like there's a couple of people like, you know, like Lou Reed and Patti Smith, you know, people start to like issue these like, you know, books of collected lyrics as if they're poetry. And it's like, no, they're not poetry. Like they're actually bad poetry, and poetry would also make bad lyrics. Like they just serve different functions. And, like I always go back to like, how does it feel? The Bob Dylan line, like that's an incredible moment in song. But that's not like a good sentence. You know, it's like, oh, what an amazing line of poetry. It's like the point of it is that it's not poetry. The point is like you need music and the singer's, you know, performance and everything else to give it life. You know, so if the words were complete on the page, you wouldn't need a song.
Yeah, that's true. It's not like he's in love with Springsteen, the poet. He's in love with Springsteen, like the full-fledged artist, the image, the rocker, and so on.
Right. You know? I mean, the character is a writer, and I mean, that is... You know, movies love writers because they tend to be written by writers.
Yeah.
But writing is also like one of the most like boring, like uninteresting things to film. So you always end up with that kind of, you know, dilemma. Like you can't make a movie about Virginia Woolf and just show her like, you know, sitting in a room, like, you know, scribbling on paper for like an hour and a half. So You have to kind of come up with other things to enliven that, which in this case is pointing at bums.
I will also say that with regard to Springsteen, he got a lot of beauty shots in this because there's like a point where like a bunch of posters from the mall have been like thrown away, I think by like a music store or something.
HMV, right? Yeah.
And so he picks them up and like takes them to his room and has this like shrine to Springsteen. And then of course he does like the requisite cutting off the sleeves off of flannel and like wearing denim jackets. And yeah, I think I never realized how beautiful Bruce Springsteen is, and you really get that in this movie. So that's good.
I mean, yeah, they didn't. They didn't like put his ass on the cover of Born to Run for no reason. Or, sorry. Born in the USA. Sorry. Oh dear, I'm gonna get exiled now. So let's.
It's America's ass. We all know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So I will say, as much as I liked a lot of the parent-child tensions in the movie, a lot of this, I wouldn't necessarily call it like filler exactly, but like it did feel really overstuffed. One of his goals that he sort of sets out for himself at the beginning of the movie is that he's going to kiss a girl. And like that whole romance is like pretty wan, I think. He takes up with this like really liberal activist girl and who is like also in this English class. And I think like the only thing I really got out of that whole relationship is like a scene where he goes to dinner at her parents' house and her parents sort of accuse her at the dinner table of like dating people who are going to be like the most controversial picks or like the most provocative picks. And then either Javed or probably more like the girl is sort of like, what do you think is so controversial about Javed? And then the parents can't really say anything. So they sort of like sit squirming silently in their seats. Like right. That was a really good scene.
Right. Because of, other than the fact that he's Pakistani, I mean, he is the most like kind of boring, like middle of the road, like straight laced guy you can imagine.
Because like his girlfriend has like a very distinctive like style, like with her hair and what she wears and so on, you know, very like sort of punk radical, so on. She keeps saying she's like anti-fascist and so on. And Javed is like, you know, other than his occasional Springsteen cosplay, is mostly pretty like straight-laced in his wear and demeanor and everything else, which is kind of funny to me. But yeah, I agree with you, Ingu. I did not find their relationship super compelling. Especially when they have like their little break. I didn't feel anything bad about it. I don't know.
Yeah. So. And then I think there's like a whole storyline with the best friend where Javed is sort of like increasingly a dick to his best friend, his like white friend that he grew up with. And there's, I think, like a certain point where the white friend sort of points out that he has saved Javed from skinheads or racists. Taunts on the playground or whatever for their whole lives. That was okay, but I think the only really interesting thing about the best friend in the New Wave group is that he is played by Tommen Baratheon and sort of has that like same hapless quality to him. So a lot of this other stuff is in the movie and just like does not really need to be there. There's a whole other thing with the English teacher who is like the type of like magical English teacher to take like a school assignment and like enter it behind the student's back into like an essay contest. And like, wow, he wins the essay contest. And then like the reward is like a trip to New Jersey. And so like Javed and Roots go on a Springfield pilgrimage essentially to like Bruce's childhood home and like a bar that like Bruce went to one time. And a lot of the stuff doesn't really need to be there. It's like very cute and it also feels very indistinct.
I mean, there's this stuff about their like neighbor too, who's this kind of elderly white man who we see. There's a bunch of sort of significant shots of him staring, you know, at Javed, and it's sort of like, is he another racist? Like, is he resent that these people have moved in next door? And then there's this thing where you find that no, actually, he fought in World War II and he thinks fascists are bad. Mm-hmm. So he agrees.
Very supportive of Javed's like career and writing ambitions.
His anti-National Front.
Exactly.
I think of all of the various subplots, the one I like the most is this like very tiny one where Javed has this occasionally uneasy relationship with his sister. He has, I think, two sisters in this, one who is getting married, who is older, and then one, I think, who is younger, who is sort of the one who is like, you're crazy. And essentially, he ends up owing her a favor. They go to something that I have never heard of called a daytimer, which is basically like a daytime club where both of them skip school and they go out dancing. And he sees his sister in like a completely brand new light because she is just like, dressed like.
Does he call her like, what does he say? Like, you look like the Pakistani Madonna or something like that? Like, she's got the sequin top and the kind of, you know, teased up hair and whatever. And
I did find it interesting that nightclub sequence was the one sequence where they were playing like any sort of like Bhangra style music or anything. Right. Like that was like the one time where like the music of where he come from is like kind of represented. So it was kind of nice that they let that also have its moment in, you know, a movie that's otherwise so saturated with Bruce.
Right. I mean, I think you hear it like in the cassette deck in his dad's car, like for like 3 seconds. And I had to look in the credits to find this, but they did get A.R. Rahman, who's like the most famous Bollywood composer, to do a new song for the film. But I think you have to like wait till the end credits after the Bruce song has finished playing to hear that. So that feels like a little more gestural than sort of actually woven into the fabric of it.
Yeah.
But it's nice. You know, he's on the soundtrack. I'm sure he's going to get a cut.
Yeah. But it's such like an aggressively like father-son movie. It was sort of nice to be like, oh, right. Like also these like women exist.
The Daytimer scene is like one of those things that it's like a lot of the stuff in this movie you've seen before, only, you know, mostly with like a, you know, white lead protagonist, but all this stuff about him, like rock and roll saved his soul and inspired him to like break with his dad and whatever. And then the Daytimer scene is like, oh, I have not actually seen this in a movie ever.
Yeah, let's make that movie.
So there's a lot of Javed, you know, finally gets his big break. He gets a kind of an internship at the local paper.
Unpaid.
Yes. Yeah. It's the 80s. He does manage to get his first byline because the reporter kind of asks around. He's like, "You're Muslim, right? Do you speak Urdu?" I need somebody to go down to like the local mosque and like, you know, translate for me. So he gets a byline. Then he gets.
Wait, can we unpack that scene a little bit though?
Oh yes. Because yeah. Sure. Yeah.
There's like a bunch of scenes where someone asks Javed something, and I think something that the movie does very well is capture the 2 seconds where usually a white person will ask a personal question, and then you have to sort of anticipate that something bad might suddenly be coming down the line, but also you can't like get bent out of shape about it because it might not be anything bad. And so like that, on the one hand, it's sort of a classic movie move, right? Like someone asks a question and then there's like suspense about like what's going to happen. But I think on the other hand is also like this very like racialized experience. Someone asking you like, are you Muslim? And then like in like those 3 beats, wondering what is going to come next. And I think it captures that really well. And I think the other thing that very tiny scene captures really well is this idea that, hey, maybe there should be more diversity within newsrooms because then you can get more news than you might otherwise.
Right, right. Absolutely. So he actually gets a byline. He does get paid for that one article. He gets £40 from it, which is just enough to buy tickets to Springsteen at Wembley Stadium, which is a gig that is about to go on sale. Unfortunately, the tickets are going on sale precisely at the moment of his sister's wedding. Who would have thought? So while his family is driving to the wedding, he sort of sneaks away. And I guess no one notices that he's not in the car to go buy these Springsteen tickets. And while he is doing that, the motorcade that's headed to the community center for the marriage runs smack into a National Front march and a counter protest that has been moved to that day. And his father and his uncle are pulled from the car and beaten, not, you know, seriously injured, but they're, you know, kind of bloodied up. There's a kind of small riot breaks out, and Javed then pulls up to see that this has already happened, and he missed the whole thing. So he, you know, kind of like he wasn't there to protect his father from this. And that sort of sets up the end of the movie where he is, you know, again, this very kind of classically tropey scene where he is like set up to, he's won his contest. He has gone to America. He's come back. Now's his moment to get up on stage in front of the school and read his story about, you know, an American dream in Luton. And then he gets up there and why don't you describe what happens next?
Yeah. Yeah, he's going up there. He's reading his poem that has been selected for this occasion. And then, all of a sudden, his father, with whom he's had a very bad break with because of his career ambitions and partly due to that incident, shows up with the rest of his family in the back. And he gets very emotional while seeing this. And while in the midst of reading his poem, he initially tries to back away, but then is prodded to keep continuing. And so then he kind of comes up with something on the fly about, you know, this is, you know, he talks about his family, you know, how much he loves and owes them. And just it was mostly centered on his family, if I remember correctly. And then,
but it's also about like his friend Matt and how he's sort of like forsaken, like he found this new exciting thing, but he kind of has left his old friends.
Yeah, like behind. In pursuit of like what he loved, in pursuit of Springsteen, in pursuit of his career, then he ended up like leaving behind a lot of things he loved, and he's trying to like find that again, circle back to that again. And it's very sweet and moving, and his dad and him eventually reconcile, and his dad's like, "Oh, you know, I love Springsteen. You know, he talks about hard work and stuff. Is he actually Pakistani?" Yeah.
But I think a lot of this sort of impromptu essay that he makes up on the spot is about how his previous essay was wrong, because a lot of it was about like how much he didn't like gluten, how much he sort of resented his family and like where he grew up. And then he sort of realizes, or he says like in this essay, that he doesn't really believe in it anymore, because what he's realized between writing that essay at the beginning of the movie and like now is that he relates to so much of like what Bruce has to say, but also it doesn't apply 100% to him. And a lot of it is about like how he wouldn't really, I guess, I don't know if like Bruce rejected his family, but like there's a lot of stuff in there about like how this sort of idea of lone wolfism, which is like, you know, basically like American individualism, right, doesn't like apply as much to him. And so there's this idea that you can look at like what you admire from a larger culture, or in this case from like a different culture, and then just sort of get like out of it what you want or what you need, and then have those elements only apply to your own life. And so instead of sort of this like process of like duplication, it's a process of adaptation, right? Like, I think that's sort of like what makes the end of the movie so powerful, at least for me, which is that he doesn't need to sort of be like a copy of Springsteen. He can be like his own thing.
Right. And I think part of it is also, I mean, if I'm remembering this right, I think it's when he's sitting in the Stone Pony and they're playing like a live, and they have like a live Springsteen, you know, concert video like playing up there. And and there's this kind of intro to a song where he talks about writing it for his, you know, sister and his brother-in-law, and going through, you know, hard times, and that the song is kind of really and dedicating it to them. And it's sort of like, oh, actually, the individualism like represented in the songs is like not all there is to them or all that inspires them. Like, he's writing about characters and a certain thing. But I mean, this is also like My Hometown is in a song that's like in the movie, but I think it's sort of that, because it would kind of blow the reveal at the end if it's like, oh, he also wrote like kind of melancholy songs about like going home and realizing that, you know, he needed to get out, but he also like misses it and informed who he is, because that's sort of where the movie ends up. But yeah, but I think that like hybrid kind of conclusion that it comes down to, like, it just makes the movie so much more interesting.
And smarter.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't know if, you know, maybe doing that as sort of like a, you know, last act twist, it's like it had an impact on me, but I, you know, maybe the movie would have been more interesting had it sort of been like folded in later rather than just being the, you know, sort of like 180 that it pulls at the end. And I'm glad it did it, at least.
Yeah, I think the way that the movie is structured is that Javed breaks away from his family, decides he's going to pursue his own interests, like a girlfriend. And then it supposedly makes him go too far. And there is a moment where he sort of is a dick to his dad, where he sort of tells his dad something, I don't know, it's like, why don't you get a job, or like, why don't you stop like wasting your time, and like, or something along those lines, where he goes too far while talking to his dad, and like the whole theater sort of did that like very predictable thing of like, oh, he said it. But I think the movie could have made him just like a tad more unlikable, and it did seem a little cautious on that end. And if it had sort of made him feel maybe like more like a teenager, really, just like more callow, it probably would have been better. But even still, I really enjoyed this movie.
Are you going to listen to more Springsteen now?
Never.
All right. On that note, please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you got your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Daniel Hewitt, and our engineer is Asha Saluja. Thank you for listening.